Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the IC, joined today by Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Hi, very good. Thanks, John.
Excellent. And Alex Janu. How are you doing, Alex?
Very well, thank you, John.
Excellent. And Alex, you've written the cover feature this week. I know you put a huge amount of work into it, so we're going to talk about that. It's essentially the Boeing-Airbus rivalry and some of the problems they've been facing. But it kind of encompasses a lovely broad theme around travel, which we're also going to talk about because we've had an update this week from Thomas Cook on their refinancing. Yeah, a groan of disgust there. It's not a pretty place to be. And we had an update from WH Smith, which is doing great business in the travel industry, yeah. Conversely to Thomas Cook. Before we do that, let's head back to last week's podcast and something Phil and I were talking about, which was Greene King. And one of the things we said last week was that the thing that investors should be doing now is looking for other Greene King-like companies that might get taken out. And we didn't have to wait very long.
Well, yes. If you're prepared to see kind of intellectual property is analogous with bricks and mortar, I think.
I thought you were going to say analogous with beer. Intellectual property and beer go hand in hand.
I don't think the Greene King takeover is so much about the beer, is it?
It's the property.
Yeah, but this is Entertainment One. You're talking about
absolutely. I guess the real analogy is basically unloved UK assets that people have perhaps overlooked a little bit. Mm-hmm. Entertainment One, we've had our eye on for quite some time. As a potential takeover target. So it is slightly different, it's not... Yeah,
Sterling, one would presume, is playing a part in it being a good time for Hasbro, who is the suitor to put in that bid, because obviously the shares are Sterling denominated. But although lots of Peppa Pig, which is the kind of jewel in the crown for Entertainment One, lots of Peppa Pig's fans are... in overseas markets.
Yeah, is it just Peppa Pig?
Huge content library, and they've got another kids brand called PJ Masks.
Never heard of it.
One child of my 3-year-old's age, you'd know all about PJ Masks.
Yeah, my kids are a little bit older than that.
Yeah,
but I do know all about Peppa Pig and seen all the programs, got all the toys.
It's obviously, this is a company which this in terms of its balance sheet, some people have been put off in the past by it. So maybe there's something similar to Greene King there. It owns a lot of content, which obviously is kind of more valuable in the days of streaming in these big platforms, kind of video on demand platforms going up against each other. But it's Hasbro, a toy company, that's come along and put in an offer. We'll see. Maybe. The content's so valuable that we'll get some more offers coming in.
Yeah, I mean, just looking back,
we're above the offer price.
Indeed, which suggests that there could be other people coming in for this, and it could be one of the streaming platforms, whether that be a Disney or a Netflix or someone like that.
Yeah, and especially when now Disney's launched their channel. I mean,
is it live? I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I haven't
signed up yet, which I inevitably will.
I don't know. It's in the process of launching it, maybe. Maybe I should say, but it's kind of, I'm not actually sure whether it's up live or not. But there's competition. What are these people? The content ownership of content seems to be one of the few things which really is going to differentiate one service from the other.
Content is king. I mean, just going back to the tip we wrote in April, E1's growing takeover appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Never have we got a headline more correct than that. But I mean, just looking at the forward PE there, it was 17. So in that sense, this is what I'm talking about in terms of slightly unloved, out of favour a little bit with the market.
Yeah.
For an intellectual property company, which it is, you would expect that to be higher.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think if you look at it on an enterprise value basis, so you take into account the debt, some of the issues in terms of the way it's financed, I think the PE isn't, telling you all of the story. Looking just at the equity on its own, it's one of those cases that you just look at the equity, you're perhaps getting a bit of a lopsided view of valuation.
Yeah, absolutely. Same as Greene King.
Which had loads of debt.
There was an interest. I mentioned the toys. I mentioned having a cupboard full of old Peppa Pig toys. And there was an interesting side effect of this deal being announced, which was that shares in Character Group, which is essentially the UK manufacturer of all those toys that I've spent money on, its shares took a bit of a beating. So explain why that happened.
Well, I guess it's, they make their toys under license mainly. And some toys are just a distributor for, but they design and they and distribute and market Peppa Pig toys, but they only do that because they're allowed to buy Entertainment One, who owns the intellectual property. So it's it's with Character Group, they came up in a stock screen just the other week, and they came up as a high quality share. And I went to some lengths to explain why they're not as high quality as the fundamentals would suggest they are.
I have the screen in front of me. Two cheap and decent sports.
Yeah,
caps.
Cheap. I decided Character Group was decent rather than high quality, because it doesn't own its own intellectual property. It does do some of its own toys, but it makes its money basically working for other people. And when you're, essentially reliant on someone else's intellectual property, then you're vulnerable to them changing the terms of the contract or just withdrawing the contract. They do actually, interestingly though, I mean, you could put together an argument that the Fools are buying opportunity because they've already got a relationship with Hasbro. So if Hasbro was successful, they make Stretch Armstrong.
Again, straight over my head.
This is it's more something that we know, because those toys were around, when we were kids.
Were they?
That toy which you you pulled the arms and they stretched all over the place.
When you two were kids.
That's quite some time ago.
We were kids, which was a long time ago. But I remember a friend of mine having one. And being fascinated by it.
All right.
But anyway, but this is by the by.
I guess the worry then is that Hasbro, being a big maker of toys itself, will just take over the manufacturing.
Well, they could. I mean, there's just that added level of uncertainty. Pigs are, massive money maker for Character. So what does the market do? Marks the shares down. But I think.
But then you would imagine someone like Hasbro themselves would use sort of outsource manufacturing.
Well, which they do with Stretch Armstrong. So there's a relationship there. So maybe Hasbro just says, we like what you're doing, Character Group, so just carry on doing it in the UK for us. I mean, it's something which your shareholders will find out about in time. But in a way, what's happened, that deal, or the approach to Entertainment One, kind of exposes this vulnerability in the business model, which has always been there,
which you had spotted. I see it very clearly in the last paragraph.
Yeah.
I mean before we move on to some of our other discussions, this to me is a really interesting point to make about stock screening, that the and actually numbers in general,
yes,
is that they can tell you something, but in isolation they tell you almost nothing, and you have to dig a little bit further into the story.
It's a good quick and kind of dirty way into a stock. You can say this stock looks like it may have something special, or it's got certain characteristics from which I can see in terms of its financial performance. So what explains that? It's not it's kind of the its financials aren't an explanation. They're kind of like, there's an underlying narrative which tells us about that, tell us why those financials are as they are.
So you basically
make a judgment based on that narrative.
You've got to put
conjunction with
the qual around the quant.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Interesting. So I don't know if we changed our view on Character as a result of this fall, but perhaps worth a. Another look, if a little buying opportunity has emerged there, we shall see.
I think we did cover it last week, and I think it stayed in a hold.
Okay.
I think, when it was covered.
We write so much, I can't even remember what I've read sometimes. should we talk about another story in the news section this week, Alex, which you've written, which I didn't mention at the beginning of this podcast, but it's a really good piece. It's in the news spotlight section, and it's looking at the tariff war, which we hear a lot about. But it's all sort of feels quite sort of, esoteric. And you've actually tried to put some meat around this and what it means for UK companies.
Yeah, I mean, charting the course of the tariff war is becoming a fool's game. And I'm not going to get bogged down in commentary on Trump's motivations or indeed our expectations of where it will go. I think from our point of view, what is most interesting, it's looking at how this might affect listed companies. So of the experts I've spoken to, they really earmark automotives and semiconductors on the whole. London Stock Exchange, just Aston Martin, and doesn't appear like Aston Martin are particularly worried about this. So we look at semiconductors and electronics.
To worry about.
No, Aston Martin have got plenty to worry about. I don't think Trump is one of them. We look at electronics. We look at companies with exposure to semiconductors in June. IQE slashed their revenue and profit margin guidance, and that took as much as 40% of the share price off.
And this is a direct result of
this you speak war. To chief executives, results, they are now openly saying that this tariff war is disrupting them. What is interesting, therefore, to look at is the companies that produce in China and how well integrated their supply chains are. So how easily can a company shift its production from China to countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand? Vietnam does appear to be a favourite. Fortunately for a company like XP Power, so they're an electronic specialist, they set up shop in Vietnam as well in 2012, and they have been steadily moving production over there. They've been bringing the standard of the products they produce in Vietnam up to that of the Chinese. And more customers are now saying, we don't want to make in China anymore. We're going to produce in Vietnam.
This sounds like a long-term trend anyway.
Because, yeah.
I mean, it's certainly happened in the clothing industry that, you know, a lot of stuff or, you know, that was made in very low-cost regions as they develop a little bit more, wages are pushed up.
Absolutely.
The producers are looking for the next low-cost production.
And what is also, I found quite interesting, is XP Power's chief executive Duncan Penny is telling me that, you know, once you made these moves, you don't go back unless you have to move somewhere else. These are not temporary measures that companies will be taking. These are permanent. There's far too much to undo. Otherwise, Vitek, they make camera supports products. And again, they've moved to Vietnam and reduced their dependence on China. I think what's interesting is, so these two companies, you know, you look at their diversity, Vitek, I think it's Vitek, produce a lot in Italy as well. So when they are actually quietly confident compared to their competitors who are wholly Chinese exposed. So I think, you know, if you are perhaps an investor with a shorter time horizon and lower tolerance to risk, yeah, you might want to shun certain sectors with exposure here. But really, this does open, I think, a buying opportunity in various companies. You talked about quick and dirty entry points, Algy. I think this may be one into companies like Renishaw, precision engineering, good quality businesses.
Renishaw is selling equipment to factories.
Yeah, exactly.
And if those factories are being set up elsewhere, presumably they have to buy the equipment off Renishaw.
So the headlines are, you know, oh my God, we have to stay out of these sectors. But really, these companies have been marked down. I think if you've got a longer time horizon and more tolerance to risk, go for it.
Sounds like we should dig into this a little bit more, put some numbers around it. I'm intrigued as to how this sort of how this impacts the margins of these companies. You know, if they're having to spend a lot of money up front to move production, but also then what that actually looks like in terms of the sort of operating costs of these businesses.
Yeah, and I mean, also we got that bigger question hanging over us, haven't we, about global slowdown, exactly, which, you know, is partly linked in with trade war, etc. And who knows?
Who,
crystal ball stuff.
Who knows indeed? Let's stick with the global theme. It leads us quite neatly onto the cover feature, which is essentially the business of global travel. Alex, you've written this really through the lens of the two main aircraft producers, Boeing and Airbus, but looking through the supply chain, obviously lots of UK companies involved in this and lots of customers buying these planes as well, including Thomas Cook, who I'm sure we can bring into this discussion. But I mean, talk us through what the future looks like for these companies, because we are at a bit of a sort of confusing juncture here in this industry.
Sure. I mean, for a long time, this has been a duopoly between Boeing, which again, this is the fruit of American privateer genius, against Airbus, which is a company that came out of a collaboration from Western governments in the face of American prowess. You know, what is happening in the aircraft industry? We're seeing, you know, a greater push towards innovation. Electric planes are a huge talking point.
Really? That sounds like aircraft. Something that's quite a long time
electric
away.
Electric planes. Yeah, but the way that they'll be doing this is it's a key theme for their M&A strategies. So rather than developing the stuff in-house, Airbus are working with Rolls-Royce, and they recently bought a unit from Siemens. It does seem like a while away, but I think they are looking to test flights in 2021. It will probably be on smaller aircraft to begin with rather than larger aircraft. And whether that actually solves the environmental question itself, this electricity has to come from somewhere, and jumbo jet engines consume an enormous amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
The extent that the current issues impact innovation is interesting as well. So it's difficult to get away from the 737 MAX disaster. These are the two plane crashes that killed 346 people and have grounded 77 MAX flights around the world. Boeing incurring huge charges and hits for profits.
Yeah, so it's had to pay compensation to the airlines that have been affected by
it. Airlines, sort of a lawsuit, you know, legal action.
And it's obviously delayed sales of planes it would have otherwise made. So the financial impact has been pretty significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And the extent of this, to which this will distract Boeing and being able to pursue its own innovation goals, and whether this allows Airbus to move further ahead. The reality is that, you know, so Airbus will look to increase their capacity by around 10% year on year. So it's difficult to envisage Airbus nicking significant amounts of business.
Well, they're always pretty neck and neck, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that said, so Flyadeal, a low-cost Saudi airline, they did cancel a Boeing order and have now moved to an all-Airbus fleet. So, you know, it happens in small portions.
I thought there was a really interesting point you make, which I hadn't really thought about, was that actually, you know, historically, airlines have always stuck with a particular type of plane, you know, one supplier, for the ease of maintenance, so that there's sort of continuity throughout its kind of logistics. This maybe changes that.
Perhaps, yeah. It costs a lot of money to retrain pilots across different aircraft within the Boeing and Airbus family, let alone transition them across. So we spoke to a number of pilots about this. The consensus appears to be with the Airbus cockpit, and it is much cheaper to move these pilots across. But yeah, there are more disruptive forces. In the past, where Boeing and Airbus have sought to take out the competitors simply by buying them off, we're now seeing the Russian government try to kickstart its aircraft production again. And I think more interestingly, China as well, with COMAC. COMAC has already got quite a lot of orders given how young it is as an entity. And these are two potential disruptors that Boeing and Airbus won't simply be able to enter into collaborations, as Boeing has done with the world's third biggest aircraft manufacturer, Embraer, in Brazil.
You mentioned in the feature that Airbus has actually moved some production to China. So obviously it's still actively targeting that market.
Yeah, so we spoke to a former Airbus employee and now a lecturer, professor of aerospace engineering at the University of West of England, Steve Wright. He said that, you know, there's a lot of political aspects that go into the decision of suppliers. You put work where you want to get customers. So Airbus will have thought, you know, we can only see it in theory here, but will have maybe thought we need to take on the rise of COMAC, the amount of state-backed airlines buying planes from this state-backed manufacturer. Let's put work here. Let's gain favour with the Chinese. Steve Wright told me that he's been involved in pitches with suppliers where Airbus has simply gone for a supplier who they didn't pick last time for the sake of maintaining a relationship. And on the other side, suppliers will turn up to pitches simply to show face, knowing that they won't get any work. So there are a lot of forces that go on here. And that is very much goes to the territory of being quite a unique industry, quite, you know, a duopoly, if you like.
Yeah. I mean, do you think Boeing and Airbus are companies worth investing in? I mean, you know, this is, I dug up some stats on air travel, and, you know, this is an industry that is growing incredibly quickly. I think it's something like 4.4 billion passenger flights were taken in 2018, and that's going to grow another sort of 5 or 6% next year as well, presumably driven by emerging markets.
Sure. And that's right. Travel is enormous. At the same time, consumers are growing more concerned over their carbon footprint. They may look to alternate sources of travel, which is why
take a carbon fiber racing yacht to New York.
Well, quite. So this is why they're trying to answer this question of electric planes. But overall, I doubt that's going to be significant. Ultimately, these companies move neck and neck. They move together. While the 737 MAX poses something of a unique challenge to Boeing, whether it's a question of investing, yeah, why not? I mean, it's difficult to think of another technology that is as safe as large commercial air travel. And actually, in terms of carbon footprint per consumer, it's not as bad as certain other travel, driving, for example.
Do you know what? Boats. Yeah, I didn't realise this. I was cruise liners. So I read that Carnival's cruise fleet emits as much carbon dioxide, or I think it was cancer-causing gases, than the entire aggregate volume of cars on the roads of Europe.
I think that's the thing with shipping fuel. It's filthy. I think it's less to do with the carbon. It's more to do with it's just disgusting stuff in terms of what the other pollutants which come out. Air travel is, in terms of coming, going on your holiday, that's kind of the worst, I think, in terms of the viewpoint that most people take on travel.
Yeah,
there's a consumer movement underway to try and encourage people not to travel by air when they go on holiday.
Yeah,
whether that catches on or not.
But then there's also the emergence of being able to buy kind of the equivalent of sort of the government carbon permit. Basically, you can offset your carbon footprint with certain financial contributions after taking a flight. So,
or buy a more expensive ticket.
Yeah, buy a more expensive ticket as well.
And you mentioned this in the feature. I didn't know about this, but I certainly know that a lot of airlines and tour operators are increasingly trying to flout their sort of green credentials, Ryanair being one of them.
Yeah,
apparently Europe's greenest and cleanest airline, which also this year has made it onto the EU's top 10 list of European polluters.
It's amazing.
It is.
These contradictions.
It is. But, these planes have become much more efficient over the years. I looked up some stats and go back to the 1960s when, sort of commercial jet travel was really starting to become established as something that everyone could do. Planes today are 50%, planes today are twice as efficient as they used to be. In terms of fuel economy.
The trouble is the growth in air travel.
It's the growth,
so massive.
I mean,
plotting the future of an industry and the kind of seriousness with which people regulate on environmental issues
none of the airlines seem to be able to make any money.
you can look at the economics of an airline, and that's easy. That's a lot easier. You're not making any forecasts. You're just looking at the fact that capital flows into the industry on the basis that things are going well at the moment, without the ability to predict the future.
Let's come on to the travel industry. I just want to round up the sort of looking at the engineering side of things by talking about some of the UK suppliers that are involved in this. So you've done a couple of really fantastic. We don't do graphics like this very often, but these are
they're great.
These are really lovely. Looking at where UK suppliers are involved in manufacturing these planes for both Boeing and Airbus, and UK engineers are deeply embedded in these.
Absolutely. And so this is why there are concerns when things like the 737 MAX has asked to happen, to what extent this is a problem for suppliers. And already Senior and Meggitt have come out and said that they have, there's been less demand for spare parts, obviously, which has hurt them. But the aerospace and defence market heavily exposed to these two. BAE Systems, not so much. They tend to focus on defence, but they still have presence in the cockpit, kind of computer controls. Ultra Electronics, landing gear. Senior do aircraft components and engine components. Rolls-Royce, obviously.
And they've had a few problems of their own on the engineering front. Mm.
And what's interesting on that is that certain planes are built with the ability for an airline to select the engine, others aren't. So obviously those who are stuck with Rolls-Royce are then... Not only might they be exposed to Boeing's issues, they can also be exposed to the woes of their engine supplier. Meggitt, safety control systems and power conversion, brakes, and then GKN, which is owned by Melrose, wing components.
It sounds like steady work for these guys. But again, there seems to be ups and downs.
What is worth noting is that there is a rollback on outsourcing, and particularly so Boeing had quite a radical supply chain model in the 2000s, where they sought to cultivate these unique partnerships with about 50 strategic partners. In a bit of cost, it didn't go well for them, and they are now on a march to insource. So that will be interesting again to see to what extent. I know, for example, Boeing, and again, M&A helps, so they bought a seat manufacturer, they entered a venture with a seat manufacturer called Adient.
Luckily, no seat manufacturers listed on the London market.
Exactly. But they may decide, and with more and more consumers becoming conscious of the planes themselves and what goes into them, the onus may be on producing these things in-house where they have greater control.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been struck how engineers like these that are involved in these big programs, it's not a steady upward stream of business for them.
But I mean, also, Rolls-Royce is a classic example of kind of, the amount of forward planning and development and the way cash flow does not match profit in any way, and the way the estimates they have to put in place to justify the product can the projects they embark on can so easily prove wrong.
So you basically,
and then they don't get the money in.
It's cost overruns on big engineers.
I mean, it's like there's such complex projects. It's and such complex planning that there seems to be disappointments all the way through quite often.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's the trouble with any kind of forecasting when you're kind of taking on work. The temptation is to always be optimistic. Really, whereas the reality is normally, that you should be pessimistic.
I mean, I look at, I was thinking, is there some cyclicality in here? But then you look at, the growth of air travel and you're thinking, doesn't look very cyclical to me. I mean, it's secular growth all the way up. But I guess then within that, there are sort of mini design cycles and stuff like that that are happening that make life difficult for these.
And also once the planes are kind of, built and they're in the sky. I mean, that's where the kind of the really cyclical bit happens with the airline people who own the airlines, because then they've got the planes, but they're not full, so they have to drop seat prices, so they're not covering costs. And then fuel prices are going. Wherever they're going. Yeah. So then you have an industry like the airline industry, the tour operators.
Backlogs are a big feature of the industry as well. And so when IAG bought these 737 MAX planes, some people were up in arms, but whereas their order might have cost them $24 billion normally, there's some analysts expect it may have cost as little as $11 billion, and these planes haven't been built yet. So it's smart business. Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, when they talked about compensation with him, when people have discussed compensation with him, he said, I don't need cash. We've got plenty of cash. I want cheaper planes next time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the airlines and the tour operators through the lens of Thomas Cook. as you've just said there, Algie, this is a business that people found it very hard to make money from. Everyone's traveling. Everyone's going on holiday every year, more and more. Further afield.
In terms of investors, I mean, it just kind of highlights what ghastly businesses tour operators are. And I mean, there may be times when people want to own them in terms of thinking, we're at a point in the cycle where, they're so cheap, things are going to come good. But I mean, over the long term, and probably for most people, always just that, the best thing to do is to stay away, because it's so unpredictable, what's going to happen in the end market. So, TUI and Thomas Cook have both been hit by Boeing's problems. They're hit, they're affected, and apparently they've been affected by the weather and things, things like, it's just like, the number of things.
Volcanic
eruptions. I mean, they're planning ahead. They're having to sit down and go, okay, how many people do we think are going to go on holiday with us next year? And then they're having to book in all the, all the seats on, flights and, rooms and hotels, etc. So it's just like, what a horrible business to be in.
And then I guess you've got some kind of technological disruption going on as well. So, Airbnbs coming along.
Absolutely. And endless things. Yeah. It's not like anyone's really got any, substantive, barriers to entry. I mean, especially now, what barriers to entry there were.
Well,
so substantially.
We had a profit warning a few weeks ago from On the Beach, which is which had a model that was doing the disrupting and sort of disrupted itself.
it's just flogging holidays on, online. It's hardly doing anything, that special. You do have to have good technology to underpin it. But I mean, also you look at that company's balance sheet, and there's so much cash sloshing through that business. And in terms of the profits it's making, it is having to manage a lot of working capital. And then also they've moved into kind of a high street business, so providing the kind of back end for high street tour operators. And there are certain liabilities which those people have to take on now in terms of the holiday fails and things like that.
You mentioned that a lot of this is basically capital flowing into this industry during good times.
I think that's always the problem with airlines, which is why there's the famous Buffett quote about the Wright brothers,
oh, yes,
and like how they would have shot down the, you know, the first aeroplane if investors should have, if they'd known what was coming. But yeah, so yeah, when times are good, as Alex was saying, you know, they're backlogged, so you order your planes, then you wait for them, they arrive, and you know, potentially the market's, you know, slowed down, it, you know, in the interim, and then you know you've got a plane that you can't fill.
You've got to flog it to a leasing company. And then lease it back of them,
well, yeah,
when the times are good.
But as soon as you're flogging it, then it's kind of like, you know, how much is it worth? It's, you know, based on what yield you can get per seat.
Yeah,
it's that horrible. It's just got one of those mismatches in terms of the investments you're having to make. And then the market you're serving. There's a kind of like, you know, you're investing, you know, with a very long time horizon, and you're investing a lot of money, and but then the demand has a very short time horizon.
Yeah, and this is really what's done for Thomas Cook. Well, I say done for him, and it's still sort of hobbling along.
Yeah, it's managed yet again to be, you know, I didn't know, it's once owned by the UK state, apparently. Thomas Cook. It's had many different owners, and it's kind of only this stint on the stock market. I mean, it will still be listed, apparently, for, you know, whatever reason, but it's only 12 years in. I think it had one other really substantial refinancing. I've forgotten how many years ago. I mean, it's
been around a long time.
It's nearly 180 years old, the company itself, but it's like, I don't think it's really made anyone any real money along the way, or maybe it has made a very few very canny wheeler dealers some money, but in terms of mainstream investors, it's pretty horrible.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, basically what's happened here, they've had to take a huge cash injection from their biggest shareholder, which is a Chinese tourism group called Fosun, probably pronounced completely wrong. And essentially it wipes out equity shareholders. You can potentially pay, but the dilution is absolutely huge.
The other debt holders have kind of injected another 450 million, swapped 106 billion of debt, I think. And it's catastrophe for shareholders.
Penny share, avoid now. Avoid. Is that about the holidays though? You went on a Thomas Cook holiday, didn't you, Alex? I remember I did once when
a long time ago when I was covering the travel and leisure sector.
And once only.
I thought, well, you know, this is interesting because we'd just had our first kid. It's like, yeah, all this is like really, you know, it's meant to be very easy. I hadn't had experience. Holidays.
A bit of scuttlebutt, eh?
And yeah, I thought, well, why not? A bit of scuttlebutt. Let's see. It was awful, awful experience. Well, the main thing was, it's pretty ghastly, the transfers and stuff. But the hotel we'd been put in was between two karaoke bars, and it was really nasty. So I ended up paying a lot more money to go and stay somewhere where we could actually sleep.
And then you've had the shares on the sale ever since.
the tour operators just are not great businesses, really.
I remember back in the day when I was an analyst, we covered lastminute.com was still...
Oh, yeah. That's the precursor of on the Beach, really.
What's the other one? E-bookers?
E-bookers, yeah. E-bookers, I mean,
they all went in the same direction. Avoid travel operators. Airlines, be careful.
Yeah, they're very cyclical.
Aircraft manufacturers, that's where you want to be.
Mm. Top of the train.
Top of all the
train
makers, yeah.
There you go. Okay.
What about selling, weren't we going to talk about selling magazines and sandwiches in the... airports, W.H. Smith.
The easiest way to make money from the
captive
travel industry.
Captive market can, sell at a very nice margin.
Of course.
The Investors Chronicle is one magazine you buy in the airport when you're bored, isn't it?
We do really well at airports.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Strange. We're going on holiday buying the Investors Chronicle. There you go. Perfect beach material.
Good, entertainment, the stock market.
Yeah, so they're WH Smith, we're obviously talking about, who had some numbers this week. Another long-standing favourite of the IC, actually. And it's one of those things that, you know, if you looked at a WH Smith, you know, in your local high street, you would sort of run a mile. You're scuttled about
it.
You think this is
that.
A horrible business. Yeah. You should go nowhere near it. But the travel business, which they've been investing heavily in, is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, I'd say, yeah, buy bottle of water and a sandwich in a travel WH Smith's and you'll want to buy its shares. Or you won't have enough money left to buy shares, probably, maybe. But I guess they're selling. I mean, what's interesting actually is they've moved into electronics with the US acquisition.
This is the InMotion deal.
Yes, it'll in part allow them to roll out their existing magazine sandwich type business in North America, which will be great. But selling an expensive bit of electronics is different from selling, a smaller item which people won't think too much about buying, even if it is quite expensive.
Mm.
Just the convenience of being able to buy it in an airport and not being able to go, anywhere else is good enough to pay quite a high price. But they've had positive comments about InMotion in the update, very little detail, but the comments were positive.
I have never understood airport shopping. Never understood it.
No, I know, but the shops are, I mean, you see a lot of people walking around. I don't know. I mean, it would just be interesting to see, how the electronics market compares. Because, I mean, whereas in WH Smith's in an airport, people are in there buying stuff. Electronic shops, people aren't doing so much buying, definitely. But there are lots of expensive items in there.
Yeah, I mean, go through Stansted. I mean, the place is basically a shopping mall.
Yeah,
And I've seen the development of the airport over the years. That's what it is. So I presume people are buying. It's just not me. We're bought an overpriced Toblerone from time to time.
Well, yeah, that's the WH Smith market at the moment, or the traditional one. But also, they're in hospitals as well.
It's a bit controversial, though.
And that is, I think that's something which is worth watching. Because, I mean, that the whole uproar about hospital car parks, well, the shop in a hospital isn't a million, miles away in terms of the prices being charged.
Mm.
So they're getting really quite big in hospitals now. So I think, that shareholders in WH Smith should, maybe keep their eye on that. And then, if they start to get pilloried there, then maybe... there are wider implications, but I'm not aware of any reason at the moment to fret about that. It's just something to definitely be aware of.
Yeah, definitely. But no danger signs right now, so definitely stays on the buy list.
Yeah, absolutely. It's doing.
I know
very
it's
well.
one of Phil's faves as well for the travel business. I always wondered if they were going to split it up actually at some point, but I don't think they will now.
I mean, also, who'd want the high street?
No one would want it. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that managed decline is probably the only option, really.
Having said that, I hadn't 202 post offices open in high streets, which is
kind
of gives them a purpose.
Yeah, it gets people in. McColl's has used the same strategy.
Mm.
Hasn't done great, but they're doing, and they've got stationery's a bright spot. They do these stationery stores, so I mean, they're canny operators. So I mean, life they can breathe into the high street estate. They are.
It's a good management story, WH Smith's, really.
Yeah, good, good strategy, definitely.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps up our travel special. Thank you, Alex, and thank you, Algie. Some really, really interesting food for thought there. Just let me talk you through what we have in the magazine alongside that. Look at the sector focus. This is about retail to resi conversion, which is something that Emma Powell has looked at, and a potential lifeline for retail landlords who are trying to cope with this struggling high street we just mentioned. A super long stock screen, Algie. Three pages.
Oh my goodness! I didn't know I'd been stretched out over there.
You have a funny idea of how much fits on a page, so
there are a lot of tables with this one. Lots of ideas.
It's a big table. What's it about?
It's about using something called the Piotrowski F score, which is that looks at a whole load of fundamentals in tandem to kind of see if a company is a kind of improving operationally without using outside financing. And it's using that against a whole load of different kind of valuation metrics, looking for cheap shares, basically.
No, it's value-based.
It's value-based, but because it's got this Piotrowski F-score quality measure, actually, interestingly, it did all right. I mean, it's done all right last year, which has been a very tough time for value in general.
Mm.
So,
lots of ideas on that big table.
But they're lots of food for thought type stock screen, rather than going into the specifics of any one company or well, you know, a few companies that I normally try and do.
All right. We have a secondary feature looking at some of the goings on in Hong Kong and how investors need to perhaps think a little bit differently about political risk. Lots of the personal finance and fund section, which they'll talk about tomorrow, including a really interesting look at very large funds in the wake of the Woodford scandal. There are a few of them out there and obviously just perhaps needs to be mindful of what's happened elsewhere. Plenty of news, plenty of results, although it's getting a bit quieter as the summer winds to a close. Thanks all for listening. Pick up the magazine in all good news agents, WH Smith among them. Up in the Air, how to invest in the tangled future of air travel. And we will be back again next week. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.